Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls.
I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay.
Hi, I'm Jen Gluckow, founder and CEO of Sales in the New York Minute and author of Jen's Top 10 for Sales Zen. And I'm here with
Jeffrey Gittimer, King of Sales.
A short and sweet introduction.
Well, I mean, if you're the king of sales, what else do you have to say? Well, I've been doing it for 28 years and I'm real damn good and my customers love me. No, I am the king of sales, undisputed. And every time I see another sales guy give a speech, it reinforces my own belief. I'm not going to mention any names, but I just saw a couple of them recently. I have to say one thing. I just saw a guy give a talk on the Challenger sale. And I would tell you, this is like a big book and people love it. I have never seen a bigger hunk of bullshit in my life.
Mm-hmm.
They go through this whole thing of all the graphs and all the people that they interviewed. They forgot one thing. The CEO makes the decision and everything else is stupid. Like, you don't need the book. You can either have that book and go through a bunch of crap, or you can call on the CEO and have him tell all the people with a bunch of crap what to do. I almost stood up in the back of the room and screamed it.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. One of my former employees wanted all of the salespeople to read that book, and I refused.
There's no way.
I refused to make my reps do it because I previewed it.
He said there's 4.2 people involved in the decision. Like, dude, no, there isn't.
How do you have 0.2 of a person?
Well, that's just an average that they took. But the whole thing is based on the fact that you have to harmonize somehow with the stakeholder. What is a fucking stakeholder?
Sounds delicious.
Huh?
A stakeholder. It sounds delicious.
No, yeah, I either that or it's somebody trying to kill a vampire.
There you go.
It's one of those two things.
But it's about like being challenging. It's not even about the people involved in the decision. Isn't it about it's ridiculous.
It's absolutely absurd. So yeah. If you want my opinion on the Challenger sale, please email me so I can elaborate on this diatribe. Totally.
Email your thoughts to producer@gittimer.com.
Yeah, producer@gittimer.com. And make certain that you say either you've read the book or you have not read the book, because I want to talk to the people that have read it and
just leave a comment in the podcast.
There you go. That's another great idea. And
very good idea.
And a 5-star review. We would like one of those as well.
Yeah, exactly. Love a 5-star review.
And the only reason we don't want a 6-star review is that it only goes up to 5.
That's right. And this is episode 3 of Sell or Die, and you guys are actually remote. We're not in studio today through the power of technology. What's going on with you guys?
Well, I just flew in from Vancouver.
And I just flew in from Paris.
And we are in Jersey City.
Okay. In harmony. Nice.
How's that for not prearranged?
We're overlooking the Statue of Liberty. And all of Midtown Manhattan.
Yep. It's really, really nice here. And it's a very sunny, if not cold, day.
Yeah, it's freezing ass cold.
Yeah, it snowed yesterday and it's still on the ground.
Well, other than the Challenger sale, did you guys have any experiences worthy of discussing?
In Vancouver, I did. It's a very nice but dark place. It's funny. I did a seminar. And if you Google Vancouver, you see all these gorgeous sunny pictures, but it's cloudy every day. So I showed the audience, I said, this is Vancouver from when you take a picture of Google, but this is out my hotel window. It's the same view. And you couldn't even see the building across the street.
Oh, man.
The audience was howling. I mean, literally howling.
You do, Jeffrey, just real quick, you've done seminars all around the world, in Canada,
yes.
United States, Europe. Do you think that sales, or in your experience, is sales universal across countries, or are there differences between United States and Canada and Europe? And
there are differences. The sale is the sale. You know, you have to give a good or give a service in exchange for money. But the way the sale is made, there are cultural differences,
yeah,
and there are certainly economic differences that make it a whole lot more challenging when I'm giving a seminar. I have to address the audience. I have to let them know that I understand who they are. for example, I was in Vancouver and I showed, I asked who the greatest hockey player of all time is, and it's Wayne Gretzky. And he's holding up a Stanley Cup. And I said, well, if you're in Vancouver, this is what a Stanley Cup looks like because you've never seen one. But if you don't know that, you can't engage them deeper. And then I showed a picture of the Gastown steam clock. So I try my best wherever I am, I try to be local or as local as I possibly can. And I actually had a Vancouver Canucks ski hat. So I put that on. I said, oh, wait, let me put my Canadian clothing on. And I put the Canucks hat on. It was engaging. And so at that point, they were relaxed and ready to listen. But in the end, Doug, the sale is a sale.
Yeah, but there's definitely cultural differences and nuances. I was just in Paris, and I was staying with a French family that I'm good friends with.
That's a throwaway line, by the way. Well, I was just in Paris, and you know what the best throwaway line is in the world?
What?
On my way back from the moon,
So the French family I was staying with is a family of all sellers, retail clothing, wholesale clothing, and I was talking to them about their sales and their issues and their challenges. And there's so many differences. I mean,
yeah, they think one bathroom in a house is a luxury
for four people. but seriously, the way they sell in the retail store.
Kid me. Come on, tell me.
is way different than our sales here. I mean, they're only allowed to have sales, like promotional sales, twice a year.
Yeah.
In France.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Whereas,
why is that?
Some government law, and it's a specific time, and you can't have stuff on sale any other time but those two times a year. And, that's unheard of here.
And the salespeople are not on commission. They're on salary, so they don't really care if they sell it or not.
It's almost the opposite here. It's like two times a year, nothing's on sale.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah,
exactly. And even those are fading because now you have the pre-Christmas sale and the post-Christmas sale. I wonder when actual retail comes into play.
Yeah.
Like February or something.
So how does that, Jennifer,
they're competing with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they can only have sales twice a year, but, on Amazon and on all the other internet sales places, they're competing with things that are on sale. So it's so difficult.
The one thing that's universal is all salespeople are socially inept. I asked the audience in Vancouver, how many of you have never tweeted? 3/4 of the audience raises their hand, and that's the same everywhere in the world. I mean, can you imagine what are these people thinking?
So, Jennifer, how do the people that deal with those restrictions on discounts or sales, how do they overcome that issue and still make sales? Because there's still businesses there, so they're still surviving. Some of them are probably still beating Amazon.
They do it with merchandising, and they do it with fashion.
Your name, Jennifer.
I'm sorry.
Did you grow hair?
Yes. They do it with merchandising and cool stuff in their windows.
This is what happens when you don't have eye contact on a podcast. This can happen.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jeffrey. They do it with merchandising. But, people there are used to having sales only twice a year. So they wait for that sale, and then they buy everything they can. One of the stores I went into, everything in the store was 10 euros. Really nice stuff. Everything 10 euros. But they know that this is their only time. It's the last few days of the sale. They have to get rid of it now because next year it will be old. And they do it. I think also relationships play a huge role in that.
Yeah. I would tell you also that they have adapted society to it.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, there's two seasons a year. Each one of them comes out right after the sale. So there's a new collection. And what they try to do is they have the new collection on display while they're having the sale so that you can come in. If you really like what's new, you can pay full retail for it. Or you can go and look and see what's on sale. So I've done it both ways. I've gone in and seen what the new collection is and bought something new and bought something on sale. And you still feel like you're getting a deal.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's cultural. So what do you, you want to talk about our webinar?
Yeah.
I mean, you're the host, right?
Huh? I'm not the host. No, you guys are the host.
We're the host.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm just the host. I'm the host. I'm the host wrangler.
Doug's the producer.
That's right.
Oh, now you tell me. I'm thinking I'm waiting for the host to go say something. Okay. So, you start, Jen. Okay. I'll start.
Who do we have today?
Our guest today is Andy Horner. And since Andy is a longtime friend of mine, and we've been friends for more than 5 years now, Andy founded Ace of Sales, but I named it. That's how tight we are with respect to our friendship. And it was meant as a follow-up program, and they wanted me to be the named head of the company so they could use my stuff. And we sold about 6,000 memberships as a result of me going back and forth with promotional things and, you know, trying to get people to, quote, subscribe. We've developed a relationship, and Andy is a creative genius. He gets it. He understands it at his core. He is an amazing graphic artist. He's a one-of-a-kind graphic artist. He schooled himself by doing cartoons and by doing website designs when websites were $100,000 a piece, and now they're like $9 a piece. But he is a journeyman with respect to creativity. And they renamed the company Outstand. And our goal today in this webinar was to talk to Andy about how he comes up with creative ideas and how he does creative things with the ideas that he has, the people that he interacts with, and the companies that he's involved with.
And we wanted to have Andy on the show because at the end of the month, you'll be hosting a webinar with him.
Yeah.
Get him or gold.
Yeah.
And it's all about follow up versus follow through.
But our talk with Andy is about his creative process. And most salespeople are not that creative. You know, they're given a bunch of stuff. They're given a business card by the marketing department. They're given a title by the marketing department. They're given a set of slides by the marketing department. They're given a brochure by the marketing department. They can't think outside of their own clothing, let alone outside of a box or outside of a, you know, whatever you're thinking outside of, because they're pounded to do it the corporate way. Everyone looks gray or some shade of gray.
Yeah, but even the marketing departments that are providing all that stuff usually aren't that creative. They have the opportunity to be creative.
If I had a dollar for every creative marketing department, I wouldn't have a dollar. I couldn't buy a cup of coffee.
You'd owe a couple dollars, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, their business cards are an example of who they are.
Yep.
And they try to do it all corporate, and they try to do it all with the color, the right color of the company. And no one's going to take your card and go, you know, I don't think the color of your company logo is the right PMS. But they're all, you know, their panties are all in a wad about it. When in fact, they don't even need a business card because their business cards are stupid. So lately, I've been telling people to get a jump drive with their testimonial videos on it and their name on it. Just give that away. No one will ever throw it away, and someone will always show it to somebody else. The purpose of a business card.
Let's jump to the interview.
Yeah, this interview with Andy Horner, you will definitely not want to throw away.
No. And what he's going to do is give you insight. He'll tell you what creativity is in his perspective.
So let's take a listen.
Yeah, here's Andy.
I'll tell you a little secret, Jeffrey. I have to order all of my pants online because no one carries them in stores.
Wow.
My size.
Seriously?
It's an extremely...
You're not like odd size.
No, I am. My legs and waist are really weird size. It's 38, 34. And if you ever look in any store for a 38, 34, no matter where you are, it could be upscale, luxury.
Wait a minute. You're a 38 waist?
Yeah.
When did you become a fat bastard?
I've been 38 waist for I've been a fat bastard for about 10 years now. No, I'm a 36, 38, but when I'm a 38, when I'm fatter, they don't make 38, 34. So it's, you know, fat tall people are screwed.
So Andy, our listeners now know a whole lot about your pants, but
let's talk about your underpants,
Andy. I'd like to know who you are.
All right.
Who
you can get my underpants in stores, Jeffrey.
Who exactly are you?
Where shall I begin? How early do you want me to start?
I would start
age 4.
No, start in college. That's good. Yeah, you know, you're a twin. Wait a minute. First of all, you're a twin, right?
My brothers are identical twins, and they're a year older than me, which had a lot to do with my competitiveness, trying to keep up to those two guys. They were exactly an inch taller than me my whole life. And as you know, for guys, then that is for women, it's all about, you know, being thinner. But for guys, it's all about being taller when you're young. And so I was always trying to keep up to them. They could dunk. My brothers could both dunk the basketball. I never could. And so because of that, it made me feisty and competitive, try to keep up to these two guys. So I'm not a twin, but my brothers are twins.
Are they older or younger?
They're just a little over 1 year older than me. So we were like triplets. So we were very close. We were very close in size. They were always just a little faster, a little taller, extremely athletic. And so keeping up with these two guys was almost impossible.
Okay. So then you got to college. Where did you go to college?
So college was, I started off at an engineering school in Virginia, Virginia Tech. And I immediately realized that, well, it was about a year into it. After the first year, I realized that it was very analytical, that it was all about systems engineering. The whole town was, it's not a white paper creativity. It's all about, it's the engineering mindset. So it's logic. And I wasn't interested in logic at that time. I wanted to be expressive and creative like an artist. So I transferred after my first 2 years, I transferred to Virginia Commonwealth University, VCU, which is known, it's a state school, but it's probably got one of the best communication arts and designs and art programs of any state school in the country.
That had to make your parents and happy, so, right?
They had no idea what I was doing.
No.
They thought I was so confused.
Yeah, but I mean, just from a tuition standpoint, there had to be a big savings there.
Well, I paid for my entire college semester by semester.
Got you.
I started working early in high school, and I saved up and paid for my college with scholarships and savings and did it all the way through. So it never cost them a dime, so they didn't care what I did. You know, they were just like, you know, getting the news, where's Andy? What school is Andy at this year?
Got it.
Where's Andy at now?
The one question that I really, really want to ask is, when did you discover that creativity was going to be your marching order? Where did that trigger trip?
It tripped early because my parents were non-conventionalists. So we kind of danced, our whole family kind of danced our own beat. But in high school, I spent so much of my time, all of my my extracurricular stuff was all in the art program. And I knew then that I was going to be using my creative skills. And I was voted for superlative, you know, the superlatives in the back of the yearbook. Most best looking or most popular or whatever. The class voted me most artistic, not autistic, most artistic. And I kind of knew by the end of high school that I was going to be doing something in the creative realm.
And so when you switched colleges, what were you hoping for?
I wanted to feel as though I could do stuff with a blank page. I wanted to just work from nothing. And I wanted it to be around storytelling. So I knew those two things, and I didn't want to be working in some type of an engineering program or having constraints. And I wanted to tell story. And so I went there, and I immediately got into the children's literature illustration program. It was all about the arts, sculpture, all of those kinds of things. And it was right about my halfway into my first year that I had a friend who had a new Mac. So I'd been using Apple since high school. In our 11th grade year, I wrote with my art teacher. I wrote the proposal to get our first Apple Mac for the school. And I when the boxes came to the high school, I met the delivery guy at the curb, and I said I got it. I ran down there. I met the delivery guy. I got the boxes onto a little trolley and took them up to the art room, put them back into the very back corner, tucked behind the file cabinets so no one could see it. And I set the whole thing up and left it there for the entire year and never told anyone.
Way to go.
I was the only one who used it.
Way to go.
I was the only one.
Wow.
I was the only one that used that computer for a year and a half in high school. And then at the very end, before I graduated and left, I trained the next person on it and left it to them. So how's that for selfishness?
I think it's wonderful.
I love it.
I'm from New Jersey.
So this guy that I met halfway through my first year at this art school, he had a brand new Mac laptop, and he sat there and taught me over the course of a few months how to use Photoshop and how to use all these programs. And it was like someone just showed me how to use a blank sheet of paper for the first time. And so I had all these tools, and you could paint and draw and typography and all this stuff. And so that was an awakening my first experience with real digital design and communication.
You know, Andy, I want to go back to something you said about the blank page, because I think a lot of creators are terrified of the blank page, but it seems like you embraced that challenge.
I can't stand working with too many axioms. When there's constraints, I just have a hard time with it. I mean, you're that way too, Jeffrey. I mean, you're a blank sheet of paper guy.
But you have to be. Jennifer and I grew up in the Northeast. If you're not on blank sheet of paper, somebody else is writing on your paper.
Yeah.
And they're scribbling on your paper. Or they're stealing your paper. And I've always been a blank sheet of paper guy, but I've been a writer, not a drawer.
There in college, we would go to this Denny's and with a bunch of these new buddies of mine. They were all artists and kind of weirdos. And we would go to this Denny's, and we had no tip money. We could barely pay for our food. And we asked the server if we could pay her in comics. And she said, sure. And so every Saturday night, we'd be there at midnight, and we would be passing these the back of the placemats at Denny's around and drawing comics on it for her. And we would just leave a pile in the middle of the table. That was her tip.
Wow.
Wow.
That's cool.
That is cool.
I wish I had him. I wish I could.
I wonder if she hated you or loved you for that.
Maybe she.
Yeah, well, she was cool. I mean, she was kind of a wacko, too. And so she loved it. And she would. She pretended she loved it. If she didn't,
I don't think
so. Maybe they're framed in her bedroom or something.
Yeah. I don't think there's a kind of a wacko. I think you're either a wacko or you're not.
Or you're not.
Right. It's like
exactly.
Kind of pregnant.
And who knows? Maybe she made a quilt out of them or something.
Yeah. So then you got creative. What'd you do with it?
Well, I spent a lot of my time in college drawing comics and writing stories. And so I was very much, it was always both writing and drawing. So I was equally interested in both. And so, but when I got out, the internet hit. The day that I graduated college, the internet came alive with browsers, Netscape. And so it was 1997. And that's 1997 was really the year that everyone woke up to Netscape. And all of a sudden the internet existed. The visual internet. We used to joke our customers early in the web design years, and we would say, just for budget sake, would you like the picture internet or the regular internet?
Yeah, exactly.
They would say, the picture internet. We're like, okay, we'll put that down. It's going to cost more. But of course, it was only one internet. But it was the internet hit, and everyone was talking about homepages, and everyone was talking about designing websites, and it was the birth of web design, 1997. And that's when I graduated, and I started working at ad agencies in Richmond, Virginia, and I told people that I was interested in this web design stuff. I'd like to help them learn to build web homepages. We called them homepages at the time, so not websites. And I said, I'll build you a homepage for this customer. We can charge them. Who knows what we could charge them? Maybe $100,000. And they said, really? Could we charge them that just to build a little web homepage? And I said, I don't know. Put it in the budget. So we did that, and we started charging adding, you know, it was like a second, third phase to the advertising work they were doing to build a $100,000 and $250,000 homepages, and people would pay it. They just were so happy that they could be on the internet.
I think now there are 25 cents to get a homepage, right?
No, now it's $8. No, now it's $8. It's $8 a month for Squarespace.
Right. Yeah. They'll build your website for free now, and then you pay.
pennies.
The hosting.
Yeah.
It has come a long way.
And you know what?
What?
And they're way better than anything they've built then.
No offense to your creativity, but they're just better.
But
they are.
But I mean, guys like you, I mean, built the foundation upon which, and you know, the principles upon which these guys have automated the process. Now, do you think that people that grew up with in the late 90s with the picture internet, as you call it, do you think that having been through that experience, you have a better perspective on how to use social media, on how to use email, on how to use the internet in general visually over people that have had it all their lives?
No, I don't. And here's why. This actually gets to the heart of a book that Jeffrey and I have been discussing for years called I'm Not Creative. And it comes to the belief that I believe there are types of creativity. My creativity is not relational. It's, and I think social media is a relational skill. Jeffrey is extremely relational. Jennifer is extremely relational in terms of their creativity. And I feel like that's why one of the reasons why they both embrace social media and they get it and they use it so second nature. For me, my creativity is not relational at all. It's communicational. I communicate. So, and communication and relationships are extremely different. You can stand on stage and you can communicate brilliantly, but then you can go and shake hands and be completely awkward. And so social media is very awkward to me because it's a different type of communication. It's very relational. It's not primarily communicational. And so that's why I'd rather be behind the scenes designing something or creating a presentation. But when it comes to the actual, the back and forth dialogue, that's not where my creativity lies. So social media does not come natural to me at all.
I will tell you, though, that your creativity shines when you're standing in front of an audience or you're talking to someone else, whether you feel the comfort or not, it is superior to others. And that I believe comes from your original creative process. The one thing that the guys who started in the internet really early and the people that explored have as an advantage is that you are naturally inquisitive and you're naturally wanting to find out how to or what's next, the same way you learned how to use PageMaker or the same way you learned how to use any of the artistic programs. It's the same inquisitiveness that you have about social media. You want to see how it works foundationally. And once you understand that, that becomes the core of how you're going to express yourself. Just look what you did with Ace of Sales and Outstand. That was fundamental creative response to what existed in the marketplace and how to make it better.
Yeah, I think you know, part of what you're talking about is that you can't fall into the same groove of other people's creativity and try to follow theirs and copy theirs and expect that you're going to come up with something original. You know, Peter Thiel in his newish book, Zero to One, talks about that today in this day and age, if you want to be extremely successful in business, you have to create something new. You cannot just iterate on someone else's creativity. And I think this is part of what you're saying. And mine was always, my brothers were one step ahead of me and I was trying to come up with something new that could prove them wrong. In early school, my brothers would come home with Fs. They really struggled academically, and they both brilliant, but they struggled academically in their younger years, grades. And I would do what I used to call saving my A's, because I was so pitiful compared to their athletic ability. I would save my A's and wait till they brought home an F, and then I'd bring out five or six A pluses and show my mom, try to do it in a real humble way. And she would, you know, really dote over my A's. And then my brothers would be in the other room ready to kill me with like voodoo dolls and everything. And I loved every minute of it. So there was this, you had to be new. You had to do your own thing. And if you copied, in my house growing up, you were ridiculed if you copied. And that's why to me, originality is so important. You have to be original.
Yeah. I love the distinction between copying or trying to catch up to your brothers versus creating something and doing something completely new and different.
Right. You have to find your own way. And this is something that you and I never have talked about a whole lot, Jeffrey, and I certainly haven't talked to you about it, Jennifer, but in my in college art school, I had this one class that changed everything for me. It was called Art and Perceptual Communication. It was this this weird, quirky class with this strange professor, and everyone said that when you took it, it would change your thinking forever. And it was all about how we see things and create symbols of things that we see, and we form these whole living forms. And it was really the introduction of Gestalt psychology. And Gestalt psychology and Gestalt thinking is all about that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And when you show a child a dashed line in the shape of a circle, they don't say they're dashed lines. They say it's a circle, because the dashed lines to them, they actually see it as a symbol, a circle. And when Jeffrey created the Little Red Book of Selling, it's that book was a lot of the same words as other people have used, but Jeffrey formed it in such a way that all of those pieces didn't just create a book. It created this new living, breathing whole that everyone was able to understand as a new original work, and you could feel the cover and the design of it, and the pages and the humor and the comics, the cartoons in it, and the Jeffrey's big words, you know, the large fonts and the way he spoke. It wasn't that each of them were a good idea. Is that it made one big idea, and it all we know it. We can see the book and feel it and taste it and know it in our minds. And that is Gestalt work. And that's true originality, that you can create these things from the same parts that somebody else has. Your competitor has the same parts, but you take the parts and you create a whole, and they still just have parts.
Okay, let me just throw this at you, though. That was a collection of 25 years worth of experience that I just called on. And I realized that, okay, I have this experience. Now I can put it down on paper. When Bard gave me the idea – and Ray Bard gave me the idea for the Little Red Book of Selling based on Harvey Pinnock's Little Red Book of Golf. I sat in a little place in Austin, Texas, a little Mexican restaurant, and the first chapter was Kick Your Own Ass, and I just wrote it on a napkin. And I wrote down, resign your position as general manager of the universe, which I knew was going to be the point five. And then in the middle, I put down about asking questions and networking, and I basically had the book pieced out on a napkin the minute I heard about it, and then took 2 more years to flesh it out. That's how important that was to me.
Yeah, but don't you think that even though your process was very you explored it and it took time and you put the pieces together and you kind of assembled it, don't you think that it was kind of like the creating of the sculpture David, where he could, you know, Michelangelo could see the work inside the stone? And you were kind of pulling off the pieces that didn't belong until you had the red book and it was right and it was complete?
Well, I don't think it's fair to compare to Michelangelo, but first of all, I don't speak Italian. But I think that the classic part of the book is how the experience met the creativity. And, I called on Randy Glassbergen because he was a guy who I totally admired as a cartoonist. And he agreed to do stuff, and it cost me half of a fortune. But I already knew the process by which a book had to be written, so I put the book up on the wall. And you're right, I did craft it. I had it at 15, then I had it at 9, then I had it, and finally I settled at 12.5, but I combined a lot of things. I didn't eliminate a lot of things, and then I had a budget of 208 pages. So there was all kinds of things that had to be put in, and I found that less was more.
Right, but consciously and subconsciously, probably both of them together, when you saw the book on the touring of Paris, right, which is where you got the concept for the cover, you knew that belonged.
Oh, yeah.
With the rest of your work.
No doubt.
You knew it.
No doubt.
See, I think that's the creative process. I think you know when you see something, you know that it belongs as part of this thing that you're making. And most people don't do that, Jeffrey. Most people will go look at a book and be like, all right, let's just copy this thing. This thing made a bunch of money, so let's just make something just like it and put our title on it.
You mentioned two types of creativity. Are there more?
Yeah, there's four. Everyone is one of four. You're either communicational, relational, analytical, which is the most misunderstood, and mechanical. Everyone is one of those four, and then everyone has a secondary as well that helps their first. But all human beings fall in those four categories.
Why do you think business people leave creativity out?
Because it's hard to monetize.
Really? Shouldn't it be considered below the line?
Well, no, they don't see it that way. When a lot of people who have money, if you look at the walls in their office, they're blank. There's no paintings on the walls. It's the last thing they budget in. All of the technology and the strategy and all of the other mechanisms come way before creativity. You could put it at the end. But when you look at the big companies out there, Netflix, Facebook, Apple, the big companies, the relevant companies today, creativity comes first. So there is a shift that happened. I'm not sure when and where and why, but a shift happened where now creativity, innovation, those things are first. But most companies still think like 20 years ago, and they're all losing. If you look at if you look at their stocks, they're all flat or losing. And I think it's because they have not embraced this new way. Creativity is now paramount. First.
For me, some of the best sales I've ever won were because I was creative or thought creatively and did something different than my competition and showed the prospect I was talking to what they needed to see in a different way. But there's a lot of salespeople out there who say, hey, I'm not creative. What would you tell them they should do to expose their creative side?
Well, it really comes down to what, you know, the one word that Jeffrey uses often to define his brand, which is value, and perceived value, if you want to use two words. But it's really about value. When I woke up to this, I had shifted from building websites to going into sales at this ad agency. That was my shift into sales, how I got into sales. Ace of Sales, that's where it began. And I had one whole year, had not made a single sale. Remember, our sales were $250,000 websites or $100,000 websites. I hadn't made a single sale. And finally, I had this one customer who sold products for saltwater tanks, and he was going out on paternity leave of all things. And so we were all of the bidders for the website for this company were trying to get his work and get his project for the website. And so while he was on paternity leave, I actually sat there and hand painted little fish as part of a mobile for the baby. You know, for the new baby, a little mobile, little fish. And I sent it to him with a note talking about when he got back to work, I'd love to have a chance to talk to him about what we could do to help him with his website. When he got back, he told me, Andy, I just want to let you know I'm back to work now. You're the only person I'm even considering at this point because of what you sent us. My wife would not use it, citing choking hazards, but I just wanted to let you know that you went far and beyond what we had expected. You really showed us that you cared and you got the job. So, I got the job. It's my first sale in the world of sales. And that right there for me showed me that I had to put my creativity into it, which was my distinct value. And that's where I learned that I could out-care, I could outwork the guy next to me using what I could do to give a greater perception of value. And so that's where it began for me. It's about the value.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, but you have to put your mental prowess to it, too. It's not just a matter of value, because a lot of people know the word value. They just misuse it. It's about applying creativity and your creative skills or the science of creativity to where you perceive value lies so that the other person can perceive that you are, in fact, valuable or that your information is, in fact, valuable. And I'm
right. And you oftentimes refer to it as ideas as well. After a sales meeting, you have to come back with something new, a new idea for them.
Tell us a little bit about how you came up with the revelation of follow up versus follow through.
We had a process selling website. It's a quick story. We had a process selling websites. And when you sold a website, here's how you did it. You went to a sales meeting, you gave a pitch. They compared it to competitors, and if they picked our proposal, then we would spend another month designing a homepage. We designed the homepage they liked. They signed off on it. We built the website over about a year. And when I saw that process, I realized that it put us at such a disadvantage. And so I changed the process in sales at this company so that we sat down with the prospect in the sales meeting, and I brought in this big whiteboard with me. And as they spoke and as they described what they wanted, I drew their homepage for them in front of their eyes. And then I said, how much is this worth to you? And they, you know, they would laugh about that. And I'd say, okay, I'd like to, if I can have 5 minutes in this room by myself, I'm going to write your proposal right now. So I would sit down with my computer while they were taking a little coffee break. I would write the proposal, print it on their printer, and then review it with them with a photo of, or with the whiteboard right there of their homepage. And so we would sign $50,000, $100,000, $250,000 deals using this new process of selling that was all based around them getting something. And they felt like they got something done, accomplished, and they were actually putting their money down on something they had in their hand. And it was half, to, in their mind, it was half complete.
Jen and I just finished a seminar in Florida where we wrote the proposal, literally finished it the night before, printed it out, gave it to the principals before I started. I called the CEO up to the platform and asked the audience, would you like more of me? And everyone went wild. And I handed the proposal.
Not like pressure.
Yeah. And I said, are we doing this deal or what? And he goes, well, yeah. And so let's sign it. And he goes, okay.
That is awesome. I love that. You had him on stage, right?
Yeah, but there's something about capturing the energy. There's something about
Everyone clapping
in the moment.
Yeah, who wouldn't like to have who wouldn't like to have that many people clapping and cheering when you're trying to get somebody to decide on a $1 million deal?
Exactly. Or the moment when they feel like you're making them this homepage that's going to look, you know, that's the newest, coolest thing on the planet, and they're envisioning all the new sales they're going to get for it, from it. Like, that's the moment. I think a lot of sales people leave and then try to follow up, and they wonder why no one's responding. Or, I called, but they didn't answer. I called and left another message. They're not calling me back. They seem so excited. It's like they lost that momentum.
Jeffrey and I used to ask this question from the stage. Show of hands. If one is worse and 10 is best, 10, hold your hand up if you're a 10 and follow up. And we would go all the way down to one, and nobody more than one or two hands in the room would put their hands up until we got to three. And then about half the room would go up at three. No salesperson feels that they're good at follow-up. Almost zero.
Wow, that was incredible. I love having Andy as a guest on our show.
Yeah, he's a thinker, and he inspires people to take newer, better actions. I think that's the best thing I can say about how he is able to communicate. And the most interesting thing, he doesn't think of himself as a speaker or a presenter, but he's amazing. Every time I've ever seen him speak, he inspires.
Yeah, he's very articulate, and he can communicate well, I think, because he's thinking creatively.
So this is what I want you guys to do if you're listening to this and you're listening very closely. I want you to repeat this particular podcast several times and take notes as you're going through it as to how this affects your creativity. Because salespeople in general or business people in general aren't that creative. They rely on other people to do creative stuff for them, and then they don't like it. So you have a responsibility on your own to be more creative. So study a book on creativity, right?
Yep.
Read Thinker Toys or read some kind of Edward de Bono book just to kind of get your mind flowing, and then figure out what you got to do. List like five things you need to be more creative with, even if it's your brochure and your business card, just something.
Yeah, make a list of that's exactly what I was going to say, Jeffrey. Make a list of three.
I took the creativity right out of your mouth.
Oh, damn it. yeah, make a list of 3 to 5 things that you want to do differently, and then make a plan to get them done. And everyone says they know they need to be more creative, but then they never do it. This should be your jumpstart.
So if you make the list of 3 to 5 things, then go get Michael Mihalko's book, Thinker Toys, open to the second or third chapter, which is Scamper, and try to come up with some ideas about looking at something that you're trying to change from a different perspective. That's the whole idea. And once you do that and you realize that you can come up with a better idea, that will inspire you to go to the next idea.
We recently used the Scamper method, like what, 2 or 3 weeks ago? Yeah. We used it for like 2 or 3 hours brainstorming how to do think about and do something differently that we've been doing for a while. And it was pretty helpful.
Yep.
Briefly,
but it's none of your business what we were using.
Yeah, we can't share what it was
right,
for.
It's a top secret.
Yeah.
Well, briefly, what is the Scamper method?
It shows you, Scamper is an acronym, and that talks about What can you rearrange? What can you change? What can you substitute? How can you look for something different so that you can figure out a new idea for something that already exists? So, for example, what can you reverse? Can you, instead of having the customer come to you, can you go to the customer? That kind of thing.
Cool. Well, Andy's going to be back, right? Andy's back at the end of February.
Andy will be back doing he's going to be doing one of our webinars.
Have you guys done webinars before?
Me and Andy, yeah, we have like 25 of them up on the Gittimer Learning Academy.
I know.
They're unbelievable,
they're
by the way.
They're actually really good.
But Andy's coming back to do his follow-up versus follow-through. And it's all about how salespeople misperceive the word follow-up, because all they do is make a phone call, get a voicemail, and they say they followed up, and they haven't. It's all about following through to where you get through to the person, actually get an action from them, and then keep the relationship rolling. So it's going to be a pretty dynamic webinar. How do you get there, Jenny?
If you sign up for Gittimer Gold, then you'll be subscribed to it. And I was just trying to figure out how they can just get that webinar if they want to.
And the answer is, I don't know. But hey, you can just go to jeffreygittimer.com, all one word, jeffreygittimer.com/gold. Now, how easy can that be? Just go there. And whatever they ask you to buy, buy it.
And here's the cool thing. Jeffrey's done a few webinars already for the year. And when you subscribe, you'll get access to the previous webinars as well.
If you just do the market domination one, you will kick ass this year. And I mean major kick ass.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you, Jen. And also, Jen, you've still got 7 videos for $7. That promotion's still going on, right?
Yeah, that is going on. It's... another website.
It's called youcheapbastard.com.
I think if you go to salesinanewyorkminute.com, it's pretty easy to get to the 7 videos.
Yeah, no, it's salesinanewyorkminute.com/7for7, all numbers, like 747, like the airplane.
Got it.
salesinanewyorkminute.com/7for7.
All right, make sure to go to iTunes or Stitcher. We're on Stitcher now for you Windows and Android users. Whoa. And subscribe. Stitcher is just another podcast delivery method for people don't have iPhones. There are still a few people out there that don't. And give us a 5-star review, and we'll be back again next week.
Begging for a 5-star review. If you think we're not worth 5 stars, don't listen anymore.
Yeah, but don't.
Subscribe and give us a 5-star review.
Yeah, exactly. Don't be stingy. Well, it was only worth 4 stars. Like, seriously? Seriously? No, I want 5 stars or nothing.
Perfect. Well, I'm Doug, and for Jen, this has been Sell or Die with Jeffrey saying...
Yeah. Go sell something, you lazy bastard. No, sell even if your ass falls off. Make a sale today, even if your ass falls off.